starting the last day of this workshop. And first talk today is Professor Kafka.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I would like to thank all the organizers of this very interesting workshop up to now. And especially François, I'm very grateful for being here in this wonderful university. So my talk will deal with the construction of fractal random series with the help of point processes and Poisson Voronoi oscillations. So maybe we'll find the topic a bit peculiar or exotic, because it deals with stochastic geometry, but not only stochastic geometry, also fractal analysis and fractal geometry. So, just a minute. So my co-author is Yann de Michel, and originally he's a specialist in fractal analysis, and we were trying to find a model which would put together fractal analysis and stochastic geometry. And as a matter of fact, I think that there are not so many models where you can compute explicitly fractal dimensions, box dimensions, Hausdorff dimensions. So this is an attempt to show you a model of a random series where you can find explicit Hausdorff and box dimensions, and they are equal. So my first part will not deal with probability at all. It will be about the classical Weierstrass and Takagi functions. So they are random series, which are functions that are continuous everywhere and nowhere differentiable. Then I will define our main object, which is this new Takagi type series with Poisson-Voronoi bases. Then the main result will be the calculation of the two dimensions. Then I will spend some time to explain how to prove this main result. And in the last section, I will introduce a dual model where also computations are possible. Okay, so let me start with a little bit of historical background of the whole story. So you know that up to the 19th century, people were thinking that all the functions were continuous, derivable, infinitely derivable, differentiable. And it came as a surprise in 1872 when Weierstrass introduced this function. It was an original idea of Riemann, I think. And what is it? This is a trigonometric series. But this is a lacunary trigonometric series because you skip some of the frequencies. And, you only keep the sinus of lambda to the n x, where lambda is a scaling exponent, a scaling factor which is bigger than 1. So, for instance, lambda equals 2. Okay, and alpha is a Hertz-type exponent between 0 and 1. And it was proved that this function is continuous everywhere and nowhere differentiable as soon as alpha is strictly less than 1. And at that time, Hermite said, I don't want to discuss these horrible monsters that are functions continuous and nowhere differentiable. And as a matter of fact, this is called the Weierstrass monster. I'm not sure. In France, it is called the Weierstrass monster. I'm not sure it is the case in Germany. Apparently not. Possibly. Okay, and you can see this Weierstrass function for different values of alpha. When alpha is very small, then the function is more and more irregular. When alpha is bigger than 1, then you will get a function which is C1. So the graph will not be fractal at all. And what about the dimension, the fractal dimension of the graph? Let me recall very briefly the definition of the graph, okay? Up to now, no problem. Then let me recall the definition of the box dimension. What is it? you take a regular grid, so with this epsilon will be the length of the edge of a cube of this grid. Then you count the number of boxes which are necessary to cover the graph of the Weierstrass function. And then this number in good situations is supposed to behave like 1 over the size of the cube to some power, and if this power exists, then, well, this is the limit when epsilon goes to 0 of the logarithm of this number divided by minus the logarithm of epsilon, where epsilon is the length of the edge, then you get the box dimension. Yes, indeed. Otherwise, you have to consider lim inf and lim sup, and they have to be equal. Indeed. And, well, it can be proved that for the Weierstrass function, the box dimension is equal to 2 minus alpha. So, indeed, when alpha is very small, it is very fractal, and it is not fractal as soon as alpha is bigger than 1. Then there is another, well, there are lots of fractal dimensions, but there is another one which is very classical and which comes from a certain measure called the Hausdorff measure. So this is the Hausdorff dimension. So let me recall that the S Hausdorff measure of the graph of the Weierstrass function is the limit when epsilon goes to 0 of the infimum over all possible covering of the graph with open sets which have a diameter less than epsilon. And what do you take? You take the sum of all diameters powers s. And then, well, there is some s, which is the first one, such that this Hausdorff measure is equal to 0. And this particular S is called the Hausdorff dimension of the graph of the Weierstrass function. And, well, this Hausdorff dimension is less than the box dimension. They may be equal, they may be not. And in this particular example, it is still open to compute the Hausdorff dimension for the graph of the Weierstrass function. It is not known. It's not even obvious that it is fractal with respect to this Hausdorff dimension. What is known is the result due to Falconer. I may give it here on the blackboard. So the H Hausdorff dimension of the graph of the Weierstrass function. So W lambda alpha is between 2 minus alpha and 2 minus alpha minus a certain constant divided by log lambda. So for lambda large enough, indeed, this is fractal. But still, this is not an exact computation. So this is due to Falconer. Okay. And What can it be said about the regularity of the function? Because, you know, these dimensions are strongly connected with the regularity, in particular the order of the Hölder regularity of the graph will provide an upper bound for the box dimension of the graph. And this function is alpha Hölder. When alpha is fixed, this is alpha Hölder. And if alpha is equal to 1, this is beta Hölder for every beta less than 1. And for alpha bigger than 1, I told you, this is C1, because you get a series which is normally called convergent when you take the derivative of your function. And, well, at that time, so it came as a surprise that we were able to construct explicitly a function which is continuous, nowhere differentiable. Then it was proved that these functions are dense in the set of all continuous functions on 0, 1, the functions which are nowhere differentiable are dense. And there was the famous example due to Brown of the Brownian motion. It does not provide an explicit construction of a function which is nowhere differentiable, but it says that almost surely the path of the Brownian motion will be continuous and nowhere differentiable. And maybe people were still thinking that they were mathematical monsters, and due to the work of Jean Perrin in his book Les Atomes, it was proved that these functions were indeed existing in physics, and that they were useful. They were not awful creatures built by the mathematicians. Okay, so it was the Weierstrass function. So still an open question, which is very natural. We don't know how to compute the Hausdorff dimension for the Weierstrass function. Then, my second example is due to Takagi, and it was introduced in 1903. Well, this is the same kind of function. So in the Weierstrass example, the signal was a sinus. Now, we do the same, but with a triangular, or a pyramidal signal, which is the distance to 2 to the n x, from 2 to the n x to z, which is a set of integers. So this is the first layer of the sum. And at each step, you add a layer, which is smaller and smaller. And so you get a graph like this of your Takagi function. And you can show in the same way that this function is continuous. This is, well, I haven't introduced yet a Hurst exponent here in the rescaling. So it is alpha Hölder for any alpha less than 1 and also nowhere differentiable. A very beautiful result due to Moldin and Williams in 1996 is the following. Well, we are able to compute the Hausdorff dimension of the graph of this Takagi function. It is equal to 1. It is equal to 1 because I didn't, as I told you, here there is no Hurst exponent. I took 2 to the n. So this is not fractal. This Takagi function is not fractal. And it provides a counterexample to a result due to Marcinkiewicz. Well, Marcinkiewicz showed that a function which is Lipschitz will be equal to a C1 function on the complement of a set with arbitrarily small Lebesgue measure. And if you remove the assumption Lipschitz and you replace it by the assumption alpha Hölder for every alpha less than 1, then this is the counterexample. This is a function which is alpha Hölder for every alpha less than 1. And still, this is not equal to a C1 function on the complement of a set with arbitrarily small Lebesgue measure. Okay, then you can generalize this Takagi function by introducing, well, this is exactly the same definition, but here I added this exponent alpha in the rescaling. So a Hurst-type exponent.
When you say a set of arbitrarily small Lebesgue measure, then it should have Lebesgue measure 0? Or am I wrong?
No. You fix epsilon.
You
fix it. Yes.
Okay.
For each epsilon, there is a function set that. Okay, so this is T alpha. So still the same series, but with 2 to the minus n alpha for the rescaling. You have the box dimension. Oh, of course, you had the box dimension for T in the previous slide. So the box dimension is equal to 2 minus alpha. It comes as no surprise. It's the same as for the Weierstrass function. And, well, it is a bit tricky to find the Hausdorff dimension. There is also a very strong result due to Le Drapier in 1992. And it shows that the Hausdorff dimension of the graph is indeed equal to 2 minus alpha. So it is equal to the box dimension, but only for almost all alpha in 0, 1. So if I fix alpha, I'm not able to say if the Hausdorff dimension is indeed equal to 2 minus alpha. So there is still an open problem here, how to compute this Hausdorff dimension for fixed alpha. And another problem, in 1 minute, I will introduce the same kind of functions with a basis which is Rd. Up to now, this is a function defined on R. And in higher dimensions, there is not such kind of results. So this is only one dimensional result and only for almost all alpha. So indeed, there is still work to do.
So it's true that alpha for widget is not this. It is known that for alpha different than... is it known that there are alpha for which it is not this?
No. No.
Maybe it's like
yes. Indeed. Okay, so I told you I'm going now to extend the definition in order to have a random series which is defined on RD instead of R. So the dimension is capital D, bigger than 2. Now you remember that each layer was a pyramidal function in dimension 1. It was a triangle signal. So now the signal will be the same. But unit, agreed. Then you take pyramids, which are equal to 1 at each center of a cube, and equal to 0 on the skeleton of the grid. Okay, so this is one layer of the sum. Then at each step, you rescale the grid, and you also use a rescaling 2 to the minus alpha. And then you can do the same. You can compute the box dimension of the graph, and you will find d plus 1 minus alpha. So it is the same as what I showed you in the previous slide, because d was equal to 1. Okay. And Hausdorff dimension calculation is still open. Nothing is known. Okay, so there is a need of modifying this model so that we will be capable of computing the Hausdorff dimension. And the main idea is adding some randomness to the model. Okay, so this is another layer of the Takeshi function. Okay, so before I do that, I add some randomness to the model, I would like to show you a toy model. So this is the Takeshi model, but instead of taking a grid, I take, a hexagonal tiling of R2. So I do the same. I have pyramids above each of the hexagon, equal to 1 at the center of the hexagon, and equal to 0 on the boundary of the hexagon. So this is my function delta, and I have the same kind of definition. So I call it T alpha x to remind me that this is the Takeshi function, but with a hexagonal basis. Okay, so I only consider the definition in dimension 2, of course. And we were able to show that the box dimension is also equal to 3 minus alpha. So d plus 1 minus alpha. So let me explain how to show this result, because it will be useful in the sequel. So, the proofs for finding the box or Hausdorff dimensions are always the same. You need an upper bound of the box dimension. If you want to have the Hausdorff dimension, you have to obtain a lower bound for the Hausdorff dimension. But here I'm only concerned about the box dimension. So how to obtain a bound for the box dimension? Well, you have to be able to estimate the number of boxes which are needed to cover the graph. And when, it's a problem which is different if the set would be just any set, but here this is a graph of a function. So it is easier, because when you take the graph of a function, you can see that above any fixed interval, every small interval of size, say epsilon, then in order to compute the number of boxes needed to cover the graph, you only need to know the oscillation of the function. So the maximum over all possible choices of y and y prime of the difference of the function applied to y minus the difference minus the function applied to y prime. So this is the oscillation at a fixed point x, so x is here. I do a translation of a box with respect to x, and I look at the oscillation above a certain box. And you can see on the picture, I borrowed this picture to Falconer. It is in his book, Fractal Geometry. You can see that it is enough to say that you take the oscillation, you divide by the size of the cube, and it should not be too far from the actual number of boxes needed to cover the graph. So you have to do that. You compute the oscillation, you divide by the size of the cube, and you sum over all possible cubes on the basis, and you have now a lower bound and upper bound. So we only need to estimate the oscillation. Now, I told you before, the Hölder regularity will give you an upper bound for the house of dimension. Well, it comes... No, not the house of the box dimension, sorry. Well, it is a corollary of this, the previous result from Falconer. Here, the oscillation, you can bound it with the help of the Hölder regularity. And you will find that if you have a function which is alpha Hölder, then the box dimension is less than 3 minus alpha, or j plus 1 minus alpha in dimension d. Okay, so we only use the fact that the function is alpha Hölder to obtain an upper bound for the box dimension. Now, what about a lower bound for the oscillation? The idea is, well, I have to find two a particular choice of y and y prime such that this difference is big, is large. So the idea is, I don't know what the function is equal to, but I do have information on the value of the function when I am at the center of an hexagon or when I am on the skeleton of a certain hexagonal grid. So I fix the generation. So you remember I had the hexagonal grid, then I rescale it by 2 to the minus n. So at each generation, I have a different hexagonal grid. So I fixed an n. I fix an hexagon, from the generation n. The center is C, and it has 6 vertices. Then I know how to compute each layer of the function from the level n, capital N, because when I am at the center of an hexagon at generation N, for the subsequent generations, I'm still at the center of an hexagon. So I know that the layer is equal to 1 at the center. And if I am at the vertex of an hexagon, at generation N, I am equal to 0, and for any subsequent generation, I'm still equal to 0. So the only problem is how to bound the beginning of the series. Okay, so I can make the choice of y equal to the center of the hexagon and y prime is equal to some of the vertices of the hexagon, and as a matter of fact, it doesn't work. It does not provide... Well, it is not possible to find the right lower bound for this kind of difference because we cannot show that the first part of the series is non-negative. So the trick is to consider the sum of two differences. So I take two different vertices of the hexagon, and I can say this is true, that the oscillation is bigger than the mean of these two differences. So I have fixed here the center of the hexagon, and I have to find a possible choice of two vertices such that this will give me the right lower bound. And I told you, I know how to compute it for all the layers of order bigger than capital N. Problem is the beginning of the series, how to show that it is non-negative. So I have to show that the beginning of the series, that the sum of the two beginnings of the two series is non-negative for a good choice of Ci and Cj, which are two vertices of the hexagon. So indeed, we can find a good choice of two vertices, Ci, Cj, such that we have this lower bound for the oscillation. Then this lower bound will bring the right lower bound for the box dimension. And how to find these two vertices? Well, it comes from the history of the center C. So C is the center of a hexagon at generation n. So I told you, after the generation n, it is still the center of an hexagon. But what happens before the generation n? Well, it can be... So here are two examples. For instance, if I take this center, this is a center at generation 2, and this is also a center at generation 1. But this one is a center at generation 2, so generation 2 is in red here, but at generation 1, it lies on an edge. So I need to know the history, where does the center lie at each level, at each generation. So it starts with center, maybe it is center, till the generation 1, but maybe it will be center, then edge, and it may be center, edge, and then it can be not at the center and not on an edge, and we will say that it is on the face of the hexagon. It is in the middle of a triangle here. So for instance, on this picture, if I take this particular center, it is at generation 3 in blue, it is a center. At generation 2 in red, it is on the edge. At generation 1, it is on the face. It is here in this triangle. Generation 1 is in black. Okay, and as it happens, you can only go from a center to an edge, and from an edge to a face. It cannot be otherwise. So we need to know when it will be, when the center will become a point on an edge, and when it happens, we will take the two vertices which are here on the edge. So that's how it works. Sorry. Okay, so it brings this lower bound for the box dimension. So now I'm going at last to speak about probability theory. So it was time. So I told you the main problem is, well, these are beautiful models, but still a lot of open questions, especially about the calculation of the house of dimension. So it is classical in probability theory to say, okay, when we do not know how to deal with a problem, we add some randomness and it may become easier. And it is the case here. So there is also, let's say, an applied motivation, need of a more realistic model for rough surfaces. You could even think of the Earth's magnetic field, for instance, on the sphere. So how to find a suitable model for describing this magnetic field, for instance. And what are the possible randomizations of this model? So there are several. You could decide that what will be random is the range, the rescaling. The rescaling at each layer. So you may add a random variable in front of the layer. And indeed, you can do some calculations with that. And there is a famous paper due to Fournier, Fussell, and Carpenter, which shows that in this way you can construct the Brownian bridge as a Weierstrass type series. Another idea would be to modify the phase at each step, at each layer. So you translate your signal by a random translation, and you ask for the house of dimension. And indeed, Hunt in 1998 was able to compute house of dimension for the Weierstrass function with random and independent translations of the layers. So you add a phase, a random phase, and then you are indeed able to compute the house of dimension. But to the best of my knowledge, no one thought of taking a random partition on the basis. They always take regular grids. They never thought of taking random partitions of RD. And, well, since we're here in a workshop about stochastic geometry, that's what I'm going to do. So, the most natural random partition I could think of was Poisson Rodin tessellation, and that's why I introduced my toy model just before with the hexagonal basis, because you all know that the hexagonal grid is a particular Voronoi tessellation with respect to the regular triangular mesh. Okay, so this toy model would say that, okay, maybe there is hope to compute the dimension for a random Voronoi oscillation. Okay, it is time for me to introduce my model. So I can be very quick on this one, I guess. The Voronoi oscillation, you define it in the Euclidean space RD. You take a locally finite set of points, chi. Then for each center, each nucleus of this locally finite set of points, you define the cell associated with this center, which is a set of points of RD which are closer to this center than to any other. So the Euclidean distance between y and c has to be less than the Euclidean distance between y and any c prime in my set of nuclei. Then all the sets of such cells build a partition, which is called the Voronoi oscillation associated with chi. And if chi is random, then you get a random Voronoi oscillation. So what am I going to do? I'm going to take a sequence of point processes. So I will take independent homogeneous Poisson point processes with intensity 1. And at each step, I will construct the Voronoi oscillation associated with the Poisson point process. So they are all independent. And at each step, I rescale the Voronoi oscillation by a factor lambda to the minus beta over d. So beta is some exponent. So I always say a Hurst-type exponent if you think of the fractional Brownian motion. Okay, then above, so you have here your Voronoi oscillation, and above the Voronoi oscillation, I will construct my pyramidal function. What will it be? So at each center, I put the value 1 and the value 0 on the skeleton of the Voronoi oscillation. Okay, so I get this nice picture. And then I have to add all my layers. And as in the Takagi model, I add here a rescaling by lambda to the minus n alpha over d, where alpha, yes?
So when you add your layers, so you initially you had the, so you sub-tessellate the each Voronoi cell. I don't understand how you do the addition of layers.
What do you mean? They are independent. Each layer is completely independent. You forget the previous one.
So you don't do like it's not on each of these pyramids or on the pyramids that you will add a substructure.
No, the next layer. The next layer is completely independent. You restart with a new point process. You construct another one.
You got something like a stick, or where you would tessellate the each one of cell.
Oh yes, you could, but that's not what we do. Yes.
Each layer. So the subsequent layers have less influence because of this exponent, this prefactor.
Of course. Well, you need to have that because at least the series has to be convergent. So. Yes, that's what I do. That's the same. I'm rescaling, but. Mm? This is a geometric rescaling.
First of all, you scale such that you get this one.
And of course, well, the lambda has no particular meaning. You could take lambda equal to 2. There will be no difference in the final calculation, of course. Mm? Lambda has to be bigger than 1. I agree. Okay, so you add all your layers with this rescaling, and that's the minus n alpha over d. So lambda has no particular meaning. This is well, a size ingredient. And in fact, I could even have decided to take only one exponent between alpha and beta, because only the ratio alpha over beta will be meaningful in the rest of the talk. But still, well, there was no reason why I wouldn't rescale in both in space and in time. Okay, so these are simulations of this random series, and the result is, as expected, the same as for the Takagi function. That is, the box dimension of the graph is equal to d plus 1 minus alpha over beta, and it is equal to the Hausdorff dimension, and this happens with probability 1. Okay, so this is more and more fractal when for fixed beta when alpha is very small, which is exactly the same as for the Weierstrass and Takagi functions. Okay, so this is my main result, and now I will spend time to explain how to show it. Yes?
Klaus?
Excuse me. Beta equals 1. No, you couldn't take beta equals 1. Still, you need... could you take beta equal... No. We cannot do that. We can take alpha equal to beta, but no.
So what is the beta? Where does it come from? It's involved in the exponent. In this case, what scale or height?
It's only greatest transparency to see the role of beta.
Yeah. I'm not even sure if it converges.
Yes.
Yes. Beta is here. This is the rescaling of the Voronoi basis.
And the capital B, what is the role of
this? What is the role of?
Capital B.
Capital D is the dimension. This is rescaling so that you get an intensity of the Poisson point process, which is lambda to the n beta.
But then you just have something like lambda to the beta.
Yes. Just a game between lambda and no.
You can write it as lambda to the beta to the minus n over d.
Yes, yes, but do not forget that you have also lambda here.
Mm-hmm. But then it's lambda over.
So, yes, indeed, that's what I said, that only the ratio alpha over beta is important here. So, indeed, I could have chosen lambda to the minus beta over d as my lambda prime, say, and then here I would have lambda to the minus n alpha over beta. Would be the same, indeed. So I have no... Right now I have no particular argument for explaining why it doesn't work for beta equal to 1, but I'm sure it does not, because we tried. I take this value, yes. But
I think that the beta can have that value.
Well. Okay. So let me discuss now how to prove this main result. So my strategy is the following. We do know that almost that the Hausdorff dimension is less than the box dimension. So we only need to find the upper bound for the box dimension and the lower bound for the Hausdorff dimension. Then, since I took layers which are mutually independent, then I can use the 0-1 law to show that the two dimensions, which are random variables, they are almost true constants. And that's because to compute the dimension of the graph, you don't need the first terms of the sum. Only the last terms are necessary, because the first terms, they are C1. So you can remove them to compute the dimension. Yes?
So there's one thing which I miss. In the initial setting, you had something which was in a compact.
Ah, yes.
This translation invariant, so you have to extend all these notions.
No. I take the graph over 0, 1 to the d.
Okay, so you have your stationary point process, but you don't look at
only above fixed compact set.
Oh, okay.
But I will use the stationarity still. Okay, so thanks to the 0-1 law, there are almost sure constants. I won't discuss the upper bound for the box dimension, but we do use the same kind of method as what we did for the hexagonal grid. So the thing I discussed earlier, this picture. So we do use this upper bound for the number of boxes needed to cover the graph. And some interesting point here is that you can show that it is Hölder, but the Hölder exponent is not enough to show, to get the right upper bound for the box dimension. So you do need to be more precise about the estimation of the oscillations. Okay, then, how to get a lower bound for the Hausdorff dimension? Well, we use a very famous result due to Frostmann. And this is called the finite energy criterion. So to get a lower bound for the Hausdorff dimension. So this is the following. If you are able to find a finite measure such that the measure of the graph is different from zero, and such that if you consider this energy, so this energy, what is it? This is an integral over mu times mu. This is a finite measure on the couples with x in Rd and h in R. And so you take this double integral over mu times mu, and you integrate this function, which is also 1 over the Euclidean norm of the difference between these two points, and you take it to the power s over 2. And if you are able to show that this energy is finite for a certain measure with the graph having a different from zero measure, then the Hausdorff dimension is bigger than s. So this is a very powerful result indeed. So it does require to construct this finite measure mu. And how to do that? So a natural idea would be to say, okay, I have my Lebesgue measure on Rd, so on 0, 1 to the d, my compact set. Then I can transport this Lebesgue measure into the graph of the function. So I take the image of the Lebesgue measure by the function which to any x associates the couple x and the value of the function at x. Problem is, I'm not sure that I will be able to show that the measure of the graph is different from zero. And also, if I wish to compute this integral, or at least to show that it is finite, I need to have a good idea of what is the distribution of the difference of the heights for two different points with the Lebesgue measure. Okay, so I need to know at least have a good estimate of the distribution of the difference of the value of the two values of the functions at x and y when x and y are distributed according to the Lebesgue measure on 0, 1 to the d. And how to compute this? Well, I know that I have pyramidal signals. So above, I know that when I am under a certain face of the pyramid, it is easy to compute the value of the function. This is linear. So I would like to be able to say, okay, if x and y, well, the problem is when x and y are very close, because this is when this function is very large. So when x and y are very close, I would like to be able to say, okay, if x and y are very close, then they are under the same face of a pyramid, so I can compute the difference of the heights, because this is only a linear function. So I need to restrict the Lebesgue measure to a set of points x, such that in the vicinity of x, we have a linear function. And I have to show that this set, so after the restriction, is large enough, and that I am able on this set to have a good idea of the distribution of the height difference. Okay, so I told you, the good thing is, if x is, so this is a focus on one of the Voronoi cells. I take x here in the middle of, well, somewhere inside the interior of the Voronoi cell. And you can see that if y is close enough to x, then their images are on the same face of the pyramid. Okay, and when does it happen? Well, when x is on the complement of this gray part. What is the gray? This gray region? Well, we have to thicken every edge of the Voronoi tessellation plus every segment between a nucleus and a vertex of its Voronoi cell. Okay, so I have this gray region, and I have to show that it is small enough. And I will show it by using the stationarity and the fact that, well, so I fix an H, which will be an exponent bigger than beta, and I ask for the property that around inside this ball centered at x and of radius lambda to the minus h over d, all the points are under the same face of a pyramid. So I will be in the vicinity of the skeleton of my Voronoi tessellation of size lambda to the minus h over d. So indeed, since I have an intensity which is lambda to the n beta, and I do know that I'm not in I am in the gray region, excuse me, with this probability, which goes to zero when n goes to infinity. Okay, and I can show this. It will be important to show that the measure I will introduce is different from zero for when I take the measure of the graph, while the volume of the intersection of all these sets that I call oscillation sets is different from zero with probability one when n is large. Okay, so now I only need to know that if x is not in the gray part, then the height difference is easy to compute, and I can find the distribution of this height difference. So I need to know what is this face of the pyramid which is above x. And this face is defined by, well, the nucleus associated with x and the secondary nucleus of x, which is here. And what is it? This is the neighbor of its nucleus in direction. Well, you construct the half line between the nucleus and x, and it will cross some of the faces of the Voronoi cell. And when it crosses a face, there is only one neighbor, and this neighbor is called a secondary neighbor of x. And well, the Lipschitz coefficient associated with this face is a function of these two centers, the nucleus of x and the secondary nucleus, which is defined, as I told you, in the following way. I take the nucleus, I construct the half line from CNX containing x, then I cross some of the faces, one of the faces of the Voronoi cell of CN of x, and the neighbor with respect to this face is the secondary neighbor, is the secondary nucleus with respect to x. Okay, so I have a computation which is very easy to compute the height difference between x and y, and then it is possible to have an explicit distribution for this height difference, and to show that GZN, so this is the density of this height difference, and it behaves like that. And then I will insert this result inside this integral, and magically it will work. We will be able to show that it is finite. And how to compute the distribution of the height difference? Well, it is only needed to have the joint distribution of the nucleus of x and the secondary nucleus of x. And you do that in the following way. You say that, well, you know that x is in this Voronoi cell associated with this nucleus. Then you do know that in all this vicinity of x has to be under the same face of the pyramid. So it means that when I take the intersection here of this cone with the face associated with the nucleus and the secondary nucleus, it has to be this intersection has to be on the face. So it means that there is no point from the Poisson-Venn process inside this region, which is a Voronoi flower, a certain Voronoi flower associated with this segment here in dimension 2. So I can compute that. Then with the use of Meeker-Slimniak formula, I have the density, and I need to do some calculation so that I will be able to find this nice estimate for the density. And by the way, I will discuss it in the end. To some point, we can generalize that to any stationary and isotropic point process with some assumptions. We don't require to have the exact distribution of this couple. It happens that in the Poisson case, we do have the distribution, but it is not needed. Okay, so this brings a lower bound for the Hausdorff dimension, and then I have my theorem. Now, I have a few minutes left. I think that will be enough. Thank you. I would like to introduce, to conclude with, a dual model. Well, you remember at first, maybe I could show it to you. Okay. The definition of the Takagi function. Okay, yes. Each layer was the distance of, well, a rescaled version of X, between the rescaled version of X and a certain point pattern, which was Z. So I could have decided that a good, randomized version of this Takagi function would be to take the distance from a rescaled version of X to a certain random point process. So instead of taking my pyramidal functions above the Poisson-Voronoi cells, I take the distance from the point to a point process, and I rescaled at each step the point process. Okay, so if you are convinced that this is another possible randomization of the Takagi function, here it is. I take a sequence of independent homogeneous Poisson point processes with intensity 1. Then I take the distance from X to the rescaling of this point process. So this function will be smaller and smaller. And I rescale, this time I rescale by lambda to the beta alpha over D. And there is no mistake here. This is a positive exponent because previously my pyramidal signal was always with a supremum equal to 1, whereas here it goes to 0. Okay, so this is one layer of the sum, and here are simulations. And, by a similar method, you can show that with probability 1, both the Hausdorff dimension and box dimensions coincide, and they are equal to d plus alpha over beta. So same kind of formula for the two dimensions. Very similar, save for the fact that here we can use the fact that the function is Hölder, and the Hölder exponent is enough to get an upper bound for the box dimension. So it is easier in this case, and it is also easier to deal with this distribution of the height difference, as expected, because it's not as complicated as the Voronoi construction. Okay, let me only discuss the problem of showing that the series is defined, is correct, is convergent, almost surely. Because now the problem is the function is no longer uniformly bounded, the distance to a certain point process. So,
So you have this sequence of point processes of higher and higher density.
Exactly.
Point closest to which you measure the distance is one and the same? Or
No. Yes, because we do need our 0, 1, low, and
this.
Yes. So the favorable event is when there are enough points from the Poisson point process inside some cubes which partition 0, 1 to the d. So it is by Borel-Cantelli's lemma, it is enough to check that this sum is finite. And indeed it happens in the Poisson case. As a matter of fact, in the Poisson case, I only wanted to mention that we have a stronger result, which was obtained with Nicolas Chenavier. Nicolas is a former PhD student of mine. He's done a PhD on the extremal values of random tessellations. Well, he's obtained a much stronger results. But in particular, we had this one, which says that we are able to find the asymptotic distribution of the maximal circumscribed radius of all the Voronoi cells. And why is it useful to us? Well, because when you are at a fixed point, you need to know what is the closest point of the Poisson point process. And the closest point is the point which is the nucleus of the Voronoi cell you are in. So the maximal distance from one point to its nucleus is indeed the circumscribed radius of the Voronoi cell. So you do need to compute the maximal value of all circumscribed radii of all Voronoi cells. And indeed, we have a result which says exactly that it is of order log gamma over gamma to the 1 over d. Okay, so let me conclude very briefly by saying that we also have estimate for all the random partitions. In particular, when you randomize the regular grid, so a dyadic mesh, and you randomize it in the following way, you take a random point, a uniform random point in every cube, and you decide that the center of the pyramid will be at this random point. And then you have to translate, and we have an upper bound in this case for the Hausdorff dimension. Then I told you earlier that we can generalize to some extent to isotropic and stationary point processes the results. That would be a very interesting thing to do that we have not done yet. This is about the regularity of the series, because I told you, if I go back to the Voronoi model, I told you the Hölder exponent is not enough to get the right upper bound for the box dimension, and it suggests that this is multifractal. That is, locally, you have different Hölder exponents, and so you would have to do a multifractal study of the graph. That is, computing the dimension of the set of all points which have beta regularity, beta Hölder regularity for every beta. Oh, not beta, gamma, say. Okay, and last thing, I told you, it would be, on the practical point of view, very interesting to extend these models to the same kinds of models on manifolds. For instance, I told you about the Earth's magnetic field on the sphere, for instance. Okay, thank you for your attention. Yes.
So what kind of problems do you think will arise if you try to do this on the sphere? Is physics quite reasonable?
Yes. I don't think there is any. we have not done it yet, but I'm pretty confident. I'm just thinking, problem is we can only do in the Poisson case, of course. Otherwise, maybe, no, I don't see any problem.
Hyperbolic plane might be different?
Hmm?
The hyperbolic plane?
True. And I have no idea about it.
I'd like to go back to the model
itself. Yes? Yeah.
One of the formats.
This one? Yes.
For instance, the sum representation, serious representation.
Hmm?
Serious representation of your function.
The series?
For instance, here you see an infinite series and it's made up of independent random variables, isn't it? Because for any n you have Poisson process for different n, these guys are independent. independent.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So it's an independent sum.
Yes, yes, and I see your point, I guess.
You see the point.
Yes.
You might think of, or we might think of having a model where we have some cumulative model, so points are arriving in time, okay? So I make the points denser and denser,
mm-hmm.
Adding, in a sense, smaller algebra.
Yes, you mean you would like to couple the layers.
Also very similar then to the Lepage representation of alpha stable random fields. In alpha stable random fields, for instance, they have a similar
Mm-mm. Yes, well,
maybe you can try to make
I would be willing to. Yes, I agree. But what would be the idea, for instance, I don't know, taking a limit when lambda goes to zero or infinity? Is that it? Or
I would try to take a Poisson sort of integral.
Yes.
Process
in
time and space. Just
yes, yes. I see your point, but I have no clue about it. But indeed, this is very natural.
Yes. The only thing we need to know is the edge length, which is given
yes.
by us, and the angle,
yes.
which is kind of given by the iterative steps. It would be really interesting to look if there are subterms occurring. I mean, that's what we know for Sierpinski gaskets also.
Uh-huh.
That the intrinsic volumes scale, of course, is a Hausdorff dimension, or is a box dimension, but then additional subterms, which are different than the vector dimension. I never thought about that, but with these simple shapes, yeah, I mean, it should be possible somehow to calculate the intrinsic volumes and these
yes.
term dimensions.
And I mean, you would like to say, okay, it is enough to have this information on the tessellation so that I can say the dimension is equal to that.
Not only, I mean, not
or on the contrary,
Voronoi tessellation
yes.
is probably very difficult because
yes.
The intrinsic volumes for the Voronoi tessellation.
Mm.
The problem. But for the hexagons or square lattice or cube lattice, should be somehow straightforward to it. Maybe I overlook some difficulties. But
so to get another term, is that?
To get fractal dimensions, which
yes.
are not the Hausdorff dimensions, but so to say the leading subterms.
Okay.
And for some models, they are just minus 1, minus 2, minus 3 of the fractal dimensions. But for iterated function systems, usually they are different.
And the idea would be that it could bring back some information about the tessellation itself.
I mean, it's
a generalization
of the fractal beyond just
yes,
the fractal
yes,
dimension.
Yes. Okay, well, interesting.
Are your methods specific to this kind of mosaic? For example, if you change to Delaunay triangulation or Poisson tessellation,
yes,
is there something specific for in your proof?
Well, in the proof, yes, there is this part where I compute the high difference, the distribution of the high difference. But I showed you that it was possible to do the same for the distance to the point process.
Yeah, but then from layer to layer, you have independence.
Ah, yes. Yes, this is required.
Same mosaic.
Yes. Haven't tried. I mean, you don't need to be so specific for the distribution. You only need to have a good estimate of the density of the for the high difference. So my guess would be that maybe we can find similar results for say Poisson line installations. I didn't try, but is it up to some point. I'm not sure it is really interesting to extend. I don't know, maybe that there is some facts related to translation which will appear in the house of in the dimension calculation, but I'm not so sure of it.
Speaker again.